With Maranatha, we get around a little. And one of the greatest pleasures I have is I've become a permission photographer. I don't take pictures of people unless they say it's okay and unless they become friends. And so I spend time getting to know people. I spend a lot of time. Very seldom do I know the same language they know. We're talking in sign language. We're laughing together over things that somehow you can laugh about even when you're on different language groups. It's just crazy. And in the process, I say, may I take your picture? And I have just had such a glorious time building this collection of friendships all around the world. The church that we belong to is in Carmichael, California. We are probably among the worst of their members. We are never home. Last year, I think six Sabbaths, that we were actually at church. And they have quit asking us if we're visiting, which is nice, I guess. But this is our sixth year of being members of that congregation. And twice that congregation has decided to go on a mission trip. And one trip was several years ago, and then there was another one this year. Well, this one was harder. The economy has really shifted. As you know, it's not easy to raise the money for 80 members of your congregation to fly someplace and do something, especially when you're responsible for helping to pay for some of what you're building. And so the church decided that they would raise $100,000 for their part of going on the trip. Well, that was hard. That was hard. Now, there was a hidden agenda. There's a guy in the community that nobody knows who it is. But he listens to what the church wants. And everybody believes he's not a member, and very few people even know this. But if he believes something important is going on at that church, once a year he'll drop a check, cashier's check, untraceable, to the church. And last time they had a mission trip, his check was for $50,000. So he kind of looked forward to that. And so everybody's praying, that everybody that knows, may he come through again. Well, he didn't. We're 2 weeks before the mission trip, which is in March. The finance committee and board get together and meet together. And there is a motion that is being presented that reads, we love the mission trip. We're really glad that we've raised as much as we have, but we're $50,000 short, and we don't think we ought to go. I think we need to cancel this thing. And it was presented, and you could feel all around the room agreement with that, because nobody knew where the $50,000 was coming for. I mean, this is a church that had to redo the organ, had to redo the front of the church, they've had to put roof on because the rain was coming in. I mean, it's just, they have really had a tough few years. And they were 50 grand short. And then a brand new board member, a female elder, stood up and said, I just have one question before we make this vote. Do you think God changed his mind? Because we were here together a few months ago and we believed without a question that God wanted us to go to Nicaragua. To the little village of Nueva Guinea, New Guinea, Nicaragua. I mean, if you're going to go someplace, why not New Guinea, Nicaragua? And I think we ought to go. I think it's crazy to not go. Did I just mess something up?
No.
Well, I usually do, but... Cool. Thank you. And she said, I do not believe that God asks us to do something. We accept his challenge. And then we back off because God changed his mind and is off doing something else. We accepted. We can't stay home. And then there were two or three others who agreed. And the next thing you knew, they'd all voted to go to Nicaragua. That somehow the money was going to show up. Because if it was God's will that they should go, they shouldn't be worried about the money. That was the way the meeting ended. And so that's the way it was presented at church the next Sabbath. 2 weeks now, $50,000, and we've got to be down in Nueva Guinea, Nicaragua. Well, Brenda and I, in March, had this unique... We had an amazing month. But we spent time in Ecuador. We spent like 8 days and 9 days in Ecuador. one of the most amazing trips I've ever been on. We started in Guayaquil down in the swollen, desperately hot, soggy, flooded part of Ecuador, and ended up in the high Andes, actually in the Amazon tributaries, clear at the top, where the water, if it rains there, it goes through Brazil to get to home. It was just glorious. And then second week we did other things down in that part of the world. Third week we were in Nicaragua, and our assignment was to go see how the Carmichael Church was doing in Nueva Guinea. They went. They were short, but they took some money out of savings and said, we're going to go anyway. This is important. So they're in Nueva Guinea, and we're there. We come in, we're going to stay in a different hotel. In Nueva Guinea, there are two things that call themselves hotels. The room Brenda and I stayed with is one of the funniest rooms we've ever stayed in anywhere in the world. It was just 1 foot wider than a double bed. And there was it's inside. There are no outside windows. There is no air conditioning. There is nothing. There is a fan that goes, ka-choom, ka-choom, ka-choom. You're not going to help at all. Maybe you'll sit, I don't know. There is a bathroom, but it's one of those things where you open the door and decide what your posture is going to need to be inside the room, because you ain't going to change once you go through the door. I mean, it is just an amazing, this is the hotel. And so Carmichael's over there in one building that's sort of a hotel. We're over here in this amazing place. If you want to know where Nueva Guinea is, all you have to do is look at any travel blog that talks about Nicaragua. Put in Nueva Guinea, and it will all say the same thing. This is the end of the road. The asphalt ends before you get to town, right at the center of what now is town. And then it goes to gravel, and out where the school is being built, that's where the dirt ends. And it goes to just a trail, a horse trail. One, I think it's Fodor's, says, you can tell you're in Nueva Guinea and that you're in a frontier town because at night there are horses tied up at the bar. If that tells you, this is the kind of place it is. Was established because when John Fitzgerald Kennedy was president, there was a huge earthquake in Nicaragua. About a third of Nicaragua's capital, Managua, was destroyed. And we as Americans helped resettle a third of the population of Nicaragua in four resettlement areas around the country. And one of those is Nueva Guinea. That's the way it started. We arrive. We go to the school, which the place where we're building this, we're building them a 400-student school in this town. And so you get out to where the school is. You finish. There's no more roads. I mean, just beyond the school. Literally, it's a horse path. And we arrive just on the morning that they are laying the corner block. For some reason, I've done a lot of these in the last few years where it's the first block that's going down, and I've never seen anything like this. They're on the concrete of the church, I mean, the school. There are two tents, and there are people in uniform, and there's pathfinders lined up, all pathfindery. And just about then, two police cars come up, and the mayor gets out. Not the mayor of Nueva Guinea alone, but the mayor of the state in which Nueva Guinea exists. Soldiers protecting him with AK-47s. They're ready to nail anybody. And we're not sure whether they're after us or protecting us or protecting him from us. Or, you know, this is really weird. Remember, Nicaragua is a communist country. Socialist communists confused. But that's where they are. They're certainly not capitalists, and they're not really friends of America. We've never really lifted some of our embargoes, and we just don't like that country very well. The mayor stands up to make his speech. I have asked that Maranatha and the volunteers from Carmichael have a special program today so I may speak. And they translate him into English. And then he begins speaking in some weird Spanish that is just bizarre. It's kind of like it's kind of like if you live in southern Georgia and all of a sudden you're trying to understand somebody from upper Massachusetts, Boston, you know, who is an attorney. Okay, and is using really, and I know Spanish, but this guy's Spanish was completely weird. And somebody else was translating him, and so I'm listening, and the translator just gets stopped. He can't figure out what the next word is. What was one I knew? And so I said what I thought the word was, and he said, okay, that makes sense, and he translated that. And then the guy made this long sentence, and the translator looked at me and said, he's yours. And so I walked up and translated everything the mayor said. Well, I translated what I wished he would say, you know? No, really. In all honesty, I did translate what he said. It's cool. And we actually have it on tape. You can see it. But I was blown away by what this guy was saying. And so afterwards, I pulled him aside and I said, I want you to tell me all that again. And so we videotaped him. Here's what he was saying. 30 years ago, there were 13 families in Nueva Guinea. That's the way we started. We were not Christians, we were not communists, we were not socialists, we were Nicaraguense. We just belonged to this country, that was all. He said, and then, crazy thing happened, the capitalist country that we were in became communist. Capitalism didn't work. And communism didn't work. And so now we're communist, socialist, capitalist. And we don't know who we are, and we're all mixed up. And I've realized, as your mayor, there's only one way we're ever going to make sense out of our community and out of our country, and out of Nueva Guinea. And that is to go back and discover the real moral values upon which we must base who we are. And we've got to learn to get along with people like the Americanos who are here with us today. And this is going to be the center of the new moral life of Nueva Guinea, Nicaragua. Amen. This is our school. And in a moment, I am going to lay the concrete block on the corner. And I'm going to lay that block on the Ten Commandments and the love of Jesus Christ. I mean, it's communist country. And my mind is going, hello. I mean, I have stories from Nicaragua back in the 70s when I was in and out of the country several times. When I got shot at, and I was in the middle where the Sandinistas were here and the Somocistas were there, and it was not safe-a-sista anywhere. Not good. And now this guy's preaching. The day was over. We got everybody. Well, it was really cool. The mayor lays the first block. Who do you think laid the second block? The chief of police. How can you lose? And then Maranatha in the local church. And it was kind of fun. And so at the end, I went to Pastor Oscar, who runs, I don't know, 30 churches or something around there, the Adventist pastor. You know, most of us have one or one. Wish we had three pastors instead of two. 30 churches for Oscar. And I said, how come the mayor likes this school? About 2 years ago, Oscar and his group went to the conference, got the conference to agree they needed a school. They got on the Maranatha list for Nicaragua. We sent Daryl Hardy to Nicaragua to take a look, to see what was there. He went out to Nueva Guinea. He looked and he said, there's no room for a school here. If you're going to build a school, I can't do it back here behind this thing you call a church. We're going to have to build the school someplace else. You got to find this much land. You're going to have, and he said, and if chances are you're going to have to spend a lot of money preparing the land. When you've got that done, give me a holler and we'll come talk to you and see if that's a good place to. How cool is that? You know, and mine's closed and yours is closed. And, but I know about this. And so I'm just going to say goodbye. And so Daryl came home. And then we got a phone call. Come back, we're ready. So Daryl went back. And he found that on the outskirts of town, you know, beyond the cows, there was this manzana of land that they had bought. $10,000 to buy the land. And Daryl said, well, you've paid for it? And he said, no, but we're working on it. Well, how much have you paid? $100. And you need $10,000. Yeah, so where are you going to get the other $10,000? And you need to hear this story because it makes no sense. He said, well, the first thing I did is I went to the conference president and I told him that you said we can't have a school unless we have land. And so we went on the land. Land's going to cost $10,000. We don't have any money. And so he said, I had permission to go to all the other Adventist churches in Nicaragua and ask for money for our school. Now try that. I mean, so you guys decide that you want to improve your school in Prescott. And so it's just fine. Go on down to Surprise. Go on down. Go on up to Denver. It's no problem. Go to Los Angeles. Go ahead. Talk to those churches. Because, yeah, you have our permission to raise money for this church, or for the school. That's what they did. And Oscar was going around and doing it. And he says, I've raised a little. And I said, how much is a little? I said, about $1,000. But there are churches that are ready. By now, in this story, today, the land is paid for, and it was paid by these other churches. It's so cool. But he said, and I've also got my father-in-law, who is not a Christian, has decided that he will loan us $5,000. And so we've taken his five, and that's been able to get us the land. And so it looks like it's going to work. And Daryl said, let's go look at the land. Well, hello, somebody's called. Do I have, is that from? Okay, just turn it off then. Is there anything else electronic here that can sing? We've got pictures and music and, man, what a deal. He looked at the land. The land was beautiful and awful. It had been raining for 3 months straight, and the rainy season still had 2 months to go. And it was just soggy. It was clay, and it was the kind of nasty clay that if you put a building on it, that building is going to just go down in one side or the other and break in half and do weird stuff. We can't build here unless, and here's the rule, you go down 20 inches, you dig the whole thing. First of all, you've got to cut down the trees that are on this thing, and then you've got to clear it out, and then you've got to dig 20 inches down. You've got to replace all of that, not with gravel, but with stones, because this is really bad land. I mean, it made good cattle land, but that's about all. So you got to do that, and then when you've got all that done, give us a holler, and we'll send our guys in, and we'll put the foundation down. Okay. So he went back to his church and said, well, first thing we're going to have to do is get some heavy equipment in and work on the land. You know who owns the heavy equipment in town? The mayor. The mayor. You got it. The mayor is the heavy equipment dude. He has three pieces of equipment. He has a Bobcat, he has a D8 Cat, and he has a grader. And we need him. And so Oscar goes over and explains what we want to do. And the mayor says, is your Daryl friend still in town? Oh, yeah, he hasn't gone home yet. Then I need him in my office tomorrow morning. So tomorrow morning, Daryl and Oscar go to the mayor's office. They're having a board of supervisors meeting, but the mayor comes out and says, what do you need? Daryl says, I need to talk to you about this school. Come on in, talk to the Board of Supervisors. So they go into the Board of Supervisors for the state. And mayor says, you guys realize that we have a 35-year master plan for Nueva Guinea and all of its suburbs and surrounding communities that we've been working on now for several years. It's complete. We're ready to present it to everyone. The place where you want to put a school is exactly on the main square, where the new town will be. My office will be right next door to that. And you're asking us to take land that has already been zoned for commercial businesses right at the square. And you're asking us now to turn that into school? We've been working on this plan for years. You want to start building like tomorrow. This is not feasible. Let's talk about it. And so they had him leave. 20 minutes later, the mayor invited them back in. The Board of Supervisors stood up, gave them all a big hug, and said, we are really proud to have a school on the main square of Nueva Guinea. They changed the zoning in 20 minutes. I mean, can you do that in Prescott? Imagine doing it in Phoenix. They did it in a communist socialist country where they don't do that kind of stuff. For Seventh-day Adventist school. So Daryl came home and said, this is weird. So they went to the mayor and said, we need you to help clear it. And the mayor came out and stood around and looked and said, you know, it'd probably take 2 weeks of dry before I could even put my cat in here without losing it in this clay. So if you're going to build a school, you better start praying for dry weather. And so Oscar went back to his church. And on Sabbath morning, he preached a dry sermon. And a lady in the back of the church, this is not a big church, the whole church is probably the size of this little section right here. And last time I checked, they had 85 members. And they sort of come and go, and you know, this is not really a very successful church in that community. You ask a taxi, can you take me to the Adventist church? And they say, who? They don't even know about it. If you go now, they say, oh, would you like to go to the church or the new school? They all know. Lady stood up and said, if God wants us to build a school, and if God has helped provide money for the school, then he can stop the water. But I think we need to be talking to him. So I would like to suggest that every morning, except Sabbath, because we're here all day anyway, that at 5 a.m., our church assemble in this building and pray for God to stop the rain. And they all voted to do that. And so the next morning at 5 a.m., they were there. And the next, this was August, and the next, and the next. And after 3 days of praying, one lady came one morning and she said, I feel I need to give something to God. And so I brought this. And she hands Pastor Oscar her cooking pot. It's not galvanized iron. It's just one of those old metal pots that gets black, black, black from having a wood fire under it all those years. And she handed it to the pastor and said, I can cook a different way, I think, and I want to give this for whatever you can get for it to help build our new school. And that same morning, another lady came in towing her cow. And she said, I've been impressed as we've been praying every morning that I need to give something so that God will know how committed I am to this. And so here's my cow. This now belongs to the church to sell for the school. Well, they got $500 for the cow. And I think they scrounged and got like 30 bucks for the pot. And kept praying, God, stop the water. And the next morning dawned without rain. But it was gray and nasty. And you know how those days are. But a little bit of wind. The next day, there was blue sky and a lot of wind. Lot of wind. Hot wind. Hot, dry wind. 3 days later, Oscar went to the mayor and the mayor said, all right, I've already got my, everybody's ready. Now I need to get your help though. We're going to go out there. We're going to do it as fast as we can possibly do it because who knows when it's going to rain again. No problem about the rain, sir. I think we got that cared for. All right, whatever, but I'm going to go out. Now, I need to know this. Are you willing to pay the cost for my drivers, for my men, for my employees, and the fuel for my vehicles? I will take care of all the rest. I won't charge you for anything more. I want this school. It's my school. We will do that, sir. Okay, so let's go. One day they dug it. They cut the trees. They moved them off. They dug it out 20 inches down. And then, you know, we've got about 3 days of really hard work that's gone on. And the mayor comes to Oscar and says, so Pastor Oscar, you got the money now for my guys. You don't have the money, do you? I have some. How much? 20 U.S. dollars. That won't help. Keep it and use it for something else. All right, I'll pay my guys. You don't have fuel money either? No, I don't. Okay, I'll take care of the fuel. But where are you going to get the rock? Well, we know, you know where to get it, but we don't have any money. All right, I will buy the rock. And the mayor went down, loaded up. Oh, so he does also have a dump truck. And he filled the dump truck, brought the loads, put it down, graded it flat, put dirt on top of it. And then called Daryl. All right, get your guys down here. It's time for concrete. And our guys went down, put in the floor for a giant educational evangelism center that will have 400 students and a 1,000-person church. Speaking about faith, huh? And about that time, Carmichael decided they were $50,000 short. But nobody said anything to anybody. In Nicaragua, one night, Oscar looked at his wife and said, "Honey, we got to go tell the mayor things." And so Oscar took his Bible, and his wife looked around the house and found a book that she treasures. It's A Crear Una Familia Cristiana, How to Create and Build a Christian Family. And I can't remember who wrote it. Do you remember? It's an English book that's been translated into the real language. And so they took those two books and they walked across town to where the mayor lives and knocked on the door at 7:30 p.m. The mayor came to his door and said, "Well, hi. Is there something wrong?" "No, my wife and I just wanted to come and visit with you and your wife. Can we come in?" "Why, sure." And they came into the little living area. And by the way, when I'm talking about houses and living areas, it ain't nothing like you got, okay? There's discounted about 400%. Take the cabins here the way they were in 1879, and that's about what we're in. And so they come in, and they sit down. They find a couple chairs and sit down, and they're in this little living talk area. Oscar says, "We came tonight to say thank you." And the mayor said, "What?" "We came tonight to say thank you for all you have done for our church and our school and the way you're making this a better city, a better state, and a better Nicaragua. And we just wanted to say thank you." And the mayor is going, and he stops and he says, wait. "You know, I've been mayor here for 4 years. No one has ever come to my house to say thank you. I've helped everybody. I've worked with this, every business around. They all know me. I've done my best to make it better for all of them. No one has said thank you." "Oh, yes, there was a couple. They came in and gave me pizza and asked for more stuff in my office." "But you've come to my house. You've got your feet under my table." And the pastor said, "Well, we just wanted to say thank you. And I'd like to give you a book." "What is that?" "This is a Christian Bible. It's my Bible. It's in Spanish, and it's for you now." And then his wife said, "And I've got this book on how to raise a Christian family. And I want to give that to you, Maria." And both the mayor and his wife burst into tears, stood up, threw their arms around the pastor and his wife, and said, "No one has ever done this for us. We're just people, but you have given us the two greatest treasures we have in our house. A Bible and a book on how to have a Christian family." And there were prayers and joyful thanksgivings in the house. Now, when the pastor told me that, I said, "That's an evangelistic story. I don't believe it." You know, I've become very calloused on stuff I hear. If they tell me 1,000 people were baptized, I take 15 Bibles to give the Baptists, I mean the people who were baptized. I just don't believe stuff anymore. So I went to the mayor and I said, "Pastor Oscar estaba en su casa hace alguna semana, ¿verdad?" "Ay, sí, mire que pasó aquella noche." And he tells me exactly the same story. Tears pouring down his face. "Nobody's ever done that for us. It's the most wonderful thing. And I have that Bible right close, and my wife, she's halfway through the book." And so Carmichael comes. They build one side wall, they build one end wall. And the dueño, the guy who owns the manzana next to it, is walking by and he says, "You guys ever going to think you might expand?" "There's a possibility. Oh, I'd be interested in selling you that for the same price if you're interested." We now have a permit from the government of Nicaragua to run a college. But the director of education for the country of Nicaragua came and looked at it and said, "All right, we're going to give you a permit for a colegio, big college. But what I want to tell you up front is don't start that way. Start with a primary school, build the next section, make that secondary, and then we are desperately needing you to build computer center and agriculture and anything else you can that will help our people learn how to be more successful and have real jobs that they can live with and make money on and have families. And if you will do that in this area, we will just love you forever. And the mayor says, and everything they do will be based on the Ten Commandments and the love of Jesus Christ. It's our school. Now, why do I go to all the trouble to tell you that story? Because it doesn't fit expectations, right? It's just it's a broken story. It's not the kind of thing that you're supposed to hear. This isn't really what we would expect Nicaragua would do or a communist mayor would do. But the amazing thing to me is, what is today? Wednesday? This morning, the church in Nueva Guinea was together at 5 a.m. to pray for the success of that project. I don't know a church in the world, except Nueva Guinea, that gets up at 5 o'clock every morning to pray that God will lead in their community's outreach. Have you ever heard anything like that? It just blew me away. I'm in love with those people. There's something there I want to be like. And all of that takes me to a story. The book of Josiah, which is found in 2 Kings 21. Now, Josiah was 8 years old when he became king. Now, I don't know about you, but I haven't met any 8-year-olds that I'd make king. He ruled for 31 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Jedidiah. She was the daughter of Adiah. She was from Bozkath. And I need to give you a little history. Bozkath, by the way, basically means nowhere. And Josiah's father was Ammon. Josiah's grandfather was Manasseh, the worst king ever recorded. And his great-grandfather was Hezekiah. His grandfather, Manasseh, killed Isaiah. Assassinated him in the palace. Cut him in half with a saw. And was the worst king ever recorded in Scripture. But then was converted and tried to fix things. And his son Ammon took over. And 2 years later, everybody just threw him out and killed him. They said, this guy is no good at all. And we'll make his son, who's 8 years old, king because he'd be better than his dad. He lived the way God wanted. He kept on the straight path blazed by his ancestor David, never taking a step either to the right or the left. I call him Straight Arrow Josiah. He never veered from the purpose, never left or right. I watched him grow up. You know, I've been around a long time. I was there when his father was there. I actually was around when Manasseh was trying his very best to make something good happen in the kingdom. My name's Shaphan. I have spent my life as the recorder in the court of the king. I've recorded things I wish I could forget. But now, I'm busy recording things that an 8-year-old boy is doing. And he is asking questions constantly. And so I and some of the others, we come and we sit down next to him. And we explain things and he listens. We teach. We worry about simple stuff like trigonometry and building codes. And we worry about really hard things like how do you get along with the kings of Assyria? And we try and explore it all. And Hilkiah is always there with me. Now he's the high priest. He's in charge of the temple. Hilkiah and I and 2 or 3 others have become the counselors for a young man who has only one dream, to live as God wants him to live. A few days ago, he called me, and he said, Shaphan, I want you to go to Hilkiah in the temple. You know, 4 years ago, by the way, it's 18 years now, and my young boy is 26. And he said, I want you to go, Shaphan, to the temple. You know, several years ago, we had people come and start giving donations so that one of these days we'll be able to build a new temple and fix the places it's all broken and clean it up. My grandfather made such a mess of it. My dad didn't help either, and I want it to be like God wants it. But go to Hilkiah and tell him to take all the money that's been collected now. It's time to distribute it to all the contractors that we've been working on. And so the contractors for the steel and the contractors for the block and the contractors for the terrazzo tile and all the rest. Just give them the money, whatever they need. They're good men. We can trust them. And let's get this thing built. Yes, sir. And so I went down to Hilkiah, and Hilkiah had been waiting for this moment. And so he just called all the contractors. The next thing you know, everybody was busy. And several days later, Hilkiah called me. Hello? You need to get down here. So I went down to the temple. In the back, underneath the holy place, the most holy place, there are caverns. We didn't know they were there. You get way down under in the caverns underneath what is the most holy place. And there in a chink in one of the cavern walls that was covered so you couldn't even tell it was there, but one of the men had bumped into it somehow and the covering fell off, was a scroll. It was a carefully parchment-loved scroll. We pulled it out. And Hilkiah handed it to me and said, you got to read this. I said, what do you mean, I got to read this? And he said, I already have. And I looked at Hilkiah and his face was as white as snow. What's wrong? You got to read it. You just got to read it. And so I sat down and by a candle down in one of those caverns, I read what quickly was obviously God's law as given to Moses. What would happen if you turned away from God? What would happen if you accepted God? How your life would be better or worse. And all the good things God would give. And all the bad things you would cause. And I started to cry. And Hilkiah said, Shaphan, your face is as white as snow. And I said, yeah, I've been reading. The king's got to see this. I know, but what's he going to do? It wouldn't be at all surprising if like his grandfather, he just said, well, just throw God out. And I looked at Hilkiah and I said, no, not this king. This king may only be 26, but this is a brilliant man. And he is centered on God. Come. And the two of us walked from the cavern beneath the temple up the road to the palace. When Josiah saw us and saw the looks on our faces, he sent everybody away and he says, what did you have? And we said, we need to go someplace really private. And so we went back into his rooms. And Josiah said, what do you have? Hilkiah found a book. A book? A book. What's in it?
You'd have to read it to understand, sir.
Well, then, read it to me. Hilkiah?
No, let Shaphan read it.
And so I took the book, and I began to read. Shall have no other gods before me. And Josiah said, wait, read it again. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Hilkiah, have you read this book before? Only this morning, sir. What is it? I believe it's the law God gave to Moses on Sinai. I believe it's the words. Sir, it's quite terrifying. It says, if we live for God, many good things will happen. And if we do not, we will cause the sky to fall. Read on.
I read. From the beginning of Deuteronomy to the end. From the words that came and were etched in fire on stone. And I watched my king, my 26-year-old kid, shred his royal robes, lie in the dust of the floor, pound his face, his hands, his knees up in the dust, and plead with God for forgiveness. And then he turned and he said, take Adonijah. He gave us a list of the five guys who've been his tutors. Plead to God with me, please. And so the five of us went back into the temple and we prayed and we prayed and we prayed. God, you see what Josiah is doing. You know what our kingdom's done. You know where Manasseh's taken us. We are so far down this road. The sky's already fallen. Is there anything we can do to turn it around? And all of a sudden I knew there was only one thing we could do. We had to get some more counsel. And so the five of us took a walk through town, clear down to the other side. And when you get far down to the other side, you end up where the tailors work. If the king needs a new suit of clothes, that's where they go. This is the place where the people who can turn gold into cloth live. There's a woman there. She is a cousin to a prophet you all know as Jeremiah. We have three prophets, by the way, in town this week. And we decided not to go to Jeremiah. We decided not to go to the other. We decided to go to Huldah for one reason. When Huldah listens to God, she always hears His feminine side. And there's more compassion. And so we found Huldah. And she said, "What do I owe this visit?" And we said, "Hilkiah found a book." "Ah, yes, God told me you'd found the law. You know? May I see it?" She took and began to read. The five of us with our heads in our hands, water of tears washing the dust away, making lines look like divisions. And then Huldah said, "Go back to the king. Tell him the book is true. Everything God promised for those who reject him is coming to his people. He cannot protect you when you choose to ignore him. But tell the king this: because he tore his robes, because he chose to repent, because he has thrown himself and the kingdom before God and begged God's grace, God's grace will flow in Jerusalem. And the terrors that are promised will not come in his life. Bring the people to the temple. It's time for a forgiveness party." And we did. We had a Passover. Do you know that the Passover had not been celebrated in Jerusalem as long as any of us could remember? We killed cows. We did everything the way the book said. We went back and we read specifics. And we did it exactly the way God had told Moses that it had to be done. We made sure it was that way. Everything. And my king, Josiah, who never swerved to the right or the left, stood in front of the people, clothed in a white ephod, not as king, simply as son of the king. "I'm proud to be Shaphan, court recorder for Josiah, God's son." What do you think? Is that a cool story? My land. Every time I think about it, every time I come across the straight arrow, I've never veered to the right or the left. That's a king I want to know in heaven. I really want to know him. He must be amazing. What do I learn from his life? I learned three things. I learned, number one, listen to those who are wiser than you. Is that a fair thing to learn from Josiah? He had a unique interest. And, others we know who his teachers were. I mean, Athaliah, the other kings. There were several young kings, and they all had help. But with Josiah, we don't know the name. All we know is that Shaphan, Hilkiah, and the other three were his tutors.
Where was he when he was 8? How was he saved? There's 1,000 questions I want to ask, but really the bottom line is, he decided to be God's boy. That's my number one learning from the whole process. Choose God. Second, listen to those wiser than you. And third, follow through. It's really interesting to me that they went to Huldah. Jeremiah was in town. But they go to the woman because, do you know why the Seventh-day Adventist Church needs female pastors? Because they've got a different level of compassion. I mean, read Ellen White's words. I mean, our daughter is a pastor in New Zealand, if you don't know that. She's a chair of the Bible department at Longburn Adventist College in New Zealand. And we just have been listening back and forth to conversations they've had. They're trying to do some work with a teacher who's not really following through like they ought. And here's Julene. She is just so intensely compassionate. And I'm thinking, Huldah lives. That's cool. I know her. They went to Huldah because they knew that's where they would get a clear picture of grace. And they got it. And they lived it. Choose God. Listen to people wiser than yourself. And follow through. So there's a young couple at Avondale College in Australia. And this young couple, Norman and Alma, aren't those wonderful modern names? Norman and Alma. Well, so they decide they're going to get married. Of course, they wouldn't let them marry during the school because it's immoral to be married during the school year. I never figured that out, but it was at one point. And so they wait till school's out. He has a theology degree and she has a nursing degree, which means she's first aid, basically the way those were. And so Norman and Alma say, married we are, and the church says, we need you, and they send them to the New Hebrides. And if you want to look on a map, there is such a place, but it's not there anymore. Now it's called Vanuatu. And so you go to the New Hebrides, you get to the New Hebrides, they put them in a little tiny island down here with another Seventh-day Adventist who's a missionary, and they teach them the language, and they try and learn how to do all of this. And there's a Presbyterian mission just down the road, and one day the Presbyterian missionaries walk over to Norman and Alma and say, this island is not big enough for you and us. You need to leave. Direct quote. And Norman said, well, if you believe that, where do you think we should go? We believe God is calling you to be missionaries to the Big Namba. And then they left. And so Norman and Alma went, they Googled Big Namba. And when you study the Big Namba, you know, it comes up immediately in Wikipedia. It says, the worst cannibals ever. Nobody gets out of there. You get anywhere close, they eat you alive. They don't even bother to kill you. Then you're gone. And it's just, the stories are terrible. Even the British Fur Company will not go to the Big Namba because everybody dies that goes there. And so now they know why the Presbyterians thought they should go there. And so they laughed and cried and couldn't forget. And one day Norman looked at Alma and said, you know, I think the Presbyterians are right. I think God's calling us to go to the Big Namba. And Alma said, I agree. That's what I think I hear. And so the two of them went to the church, got permission, went over to Malekula, which is the big island that has the little Namba and the big Namba and the huge Namba on it. And they stayed with a little British trader. And they learned as much of the language as they could. And after a year and a half, one day Norman said, I'm ready. And they had a special prayer, and Norman and a young teenage boy who is a Namba started walking up the trail towards the Big Namba, way back there. Immediately, they knew they were being watched. You know, you can tell. It's kind of like when you were in high school or academy and you could tell when the girl was looking at you. Same thing. You could feel there's somebody out there in the woods who's watching everything I'm doing. And so Norman would sing, and the little boy, the kid with him would go, I've got to go home. And he kept him coming. It took 7 days. They walked up towards the volcano until they got right to the far tip of the island where the Big Namba theoretically lived. Came over a hill, found themselves under the meeting tree. A baobab was probably 150 feet wide. These trees are just incredible, especially over there. Banyan, thank you. Well, you know, if you're in Africa, it's a baobab. Underneath the tree was the chief of the Big Namba. Beside him were all the lesser chiefs. Behind them were the Big Namba warriors. And over there, the women were making lunch. And the chief said, and Norman walked up to the chief. Nobody knows what happened to the kid. He just disappears from the story. I hope he tasted good. No, I'm sure that was not part of it. But anyway, the chief says, and this is recorded, "What gifts have you brought me?" In Namba. And Norman, who has for some reason planned an answer to that, said, "I have brought you three gifts. First, I have brought you medicine to heal your illnesses. And I can help you feel better and get rid of some of those. Second, I have brought you a book written by the one who made us all. A book that will teach you how to live and will make you happy. And third, I have brought you my heart. And I give it to you as a friend. That's what I have brought." And the chief said, "You have answered well. For the last several months, I have been dreaming. The dream says that a man with dead skin will walk up the trail. and that he will bring three gifts. He will bring medicines to heal our diseases. He will bring a book written by the one who made us to give us hope. And third, he will bring his heart to be our friend. You are always welcome among the Big Namba. Please come live with us." And so Norman and Alma Wiles began mission stations among the Big Namba. They treated them. Everybody had malaria. Everybody had dengue fever. Everybody had typhoid. And they could treat a lot of that. And they kept using up all of their quinine and everything. And they taught them about the Bible. And they started schools all over the island of Malekula. And the Big Namba, who had been the cannibals, suddenly became Adventists. Cannibals. But they didn't eat people anymore. They ate Vigilinx! No, they actually ate, Weedy-Bix. they were everything transformed. If you go back in history and go to Vanuatu and the Battle of the Coral Sea, several times crucial assistance to the Allies was given by the Big Namba, who happened to be Adventists. It's just really cool stories. It goes on and on. And then one day, Alma had gone back down to their original house with the little British trader down there whose eyes were big and his heart was amazed that these guys were actually friends of the Big Namba. And she was working, and four Big Namba warriors came in carrying her husband in a litter. And they set him down and they said, the chief said to bring him to you. He is so sick with malaria. He needs you. And then they went home. And what Alma knew is that she'd used up all her quinine on the Big Namba. There was no medicine. And that night she held her husband as he died. She went out back, she dug a grave, and she buried Norman Wiles on the island of Malekula, a gift from God to the Big Namba. When Norman died, he was 27. You know, I've thought about that story so much since I heard it a year and a half ago. I was in Vanuatu listening to Malekula types and Namba types tell about their past and where they came from. And I heard again and again, choose God. Listen to those wiser than you. Follow through. It's the rule. It's what makes life worth living. Now, I told that story, Kingman, Arizona. You know where that is? It's a long ways from anywhere. Unless you're wanting to park a big jet. And then it's a perfect place to go. It's like Tucson. You're outside of Tucson and outside of Kingman. There are these runways packed. That one up there is Delta and DHL. I told the story, and after the service, a lady said, I want to talk to you. Well, you know, I'm not sure what I'm in trouble for, but she sounded like my mom. And so we went out in the foyer, and then she said, I can't even talk here. You got to come outside. And so we walked out front, and she said, I knew Alma Wiles. I said, you did? She said, she was my nursing instructor at Glendale School of Nursing. She came to the United States after she left the Malakula, the Big Nambas. She came to the United States. She taught nursing several places around the country. She taught in Washington Adventist Hospital. She taught at PUC for a while, and she taught at Glendale. And I said, well, tell me about her. And she said, while you were talking, I was trying my best to remember. And the best thing I can tell you is I've never met a kinder woman in my life. She loved us. She was just like I want God to be. I would make a mistake, and she would show me how to do it right and love me in the process. I told that same story in Oklahoma. And I had a crowd there one day, and I was telling the story, and at the end, two boys came up to me. And they said, you know, Alma Wiles. And then they started tracing back to where she was a great aunt somehow. And they had the same story. Never have we met someone who was so much like Jesus. It was as if, and you know what I'm going to say now, don't you? She never veered to the right or the left. She just followed God. We want to be like her. So those are my tales for you for tonight. And the book is the book of Josiah. You can find it in your Bible in 2 Kings 22. You got it. Please go there and take a look. But before you go away, there's something I want to show you. And I've got to click this, and then, of course, it's got to remember that it has electricity and that Kim do color. Let's see if I did it right. Yep. I want to show you a picture of Norman and Alma Wiles and the Big Namba chief. I could not believe this existed, but it does. And it's a picture of Norman and Alma, and they look like missionaries. And next to them is the Big Namba chief and two of his sub-chiefs. The dates? Oh, tell me, when was that? He died in, I think, 1921, after, you know, these are kids, these are college graduates, decided to go change the world. And it worked. That isn't working. Okay, so somewhere here I'm supposed to be clicking to something else and it's not responding. No. Okay, how come all of a sudden I don't have any of my... Oh, can't do that. I just take it away. Now I should be back. I am. Okay, I'll be back in just a second. I got to go to the right page. I'm there. There you go. Hello, I'm here. I promise. There he is. You want to kill a light for me? One of the ones up here, please. They're back there by the fire. Don't turn off the red one. Norman, Alma, the big chief, and his two subordinates. Now, what do you think? Does it matter how terrifying the job is? No. Because wherever you go, you're walking in God's shoes. And there's no need to veer to the right or the left. And what are the three rules? Choose God. What's the second one? Listen to people who know more than you. And three, follow through. Lord, take us. Keep us unswervingly yours. And thanks for the privilege of being your kids. Amen.